Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Personal finance journalism doesn't usually make the list of the world's riskiest jobs, but sometimes the topic does touch a nerve.
There was all this hate mail coming in from people who were saying, you know, you're encouraging people to break contracts and walk away from their obligations.
Hate mail about mortgages. Is that really where we are? And what's scarier than a shark attack? A phishing attack.
3.6 million American adults lost money in phishing attacks, costing some $3.2 billion.
That's phishing with a PH, and online scams are on the rise. Meanwhile, if you thought the golden years were right around the corner, but the stock market is not cooperating, there are other ways to get yourself there.
Things like working a little bit longer, saving a little bit more, delaying Social Security.
That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. One of the hallmarks of this financial crisis is that the unthinkable has become thinkable. No, the government would never let a century-old investment bank go under. Hello, Lehman Brothers. There's no such thing as too big to fail. Try Citigroup and Bank of America. You put a buck into a money market fund, you're gonna get a buck back. Well, at least on that one, we might be getting some of the unthinkability back. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers.
At a time when the mattress looks like a great place to stash cash, the money market fund industry is trying to come up with ways to reassure consumers their money is safe. This week, it proposed some new rules that could lower yields for those funds, but provide more safety to investors. Among other things, regulators could look into any fund that's offering significantly higher yields than the rest. And the funds themselves could put a temporary stop to withdrawals if there are so many that the fund could have trouble paying a dollar for a dollar. Tamara Keith has more.
It's known as breaking the buck. On September 16th, the nation's oldest money market fund watched its shares sink below a dollar. The reserve primary fund had invested in Lehman Brothers, and Lehman had filed for bankruptcy. For money market funds, it was only the second time the buck had ever broken. That broken industry mantra, too.
A dollar is a dollar.
Mike McNamee is with the Investment Company Institute, a trade association. Money market funds are designed to be relatively low risk with fairly small yields. The funds invest in things like U.S. treasuries, municipal bonds, CDs, and commercial paper, and then sell shares to investors.
People don't even think about shares when it comes to money market funds, right? You think, I put in $100, I got $100. That is one of the core strengths of the product.
But when the buck broke at the reserve primary fund, investors freaked. Institutional investors pulled billions out of money market funds within a couple of days. That's when the Treasury stepped in, insuring deposits. The insurance doesn't cover new investments, and the program is set to expire next month.
My name is Chris Donahue, and I am president and CEO of Federated Investors, Inc. in Pittsburgh.
Federated manages $325 billion in assets for 50 different money market funds. Federated is part of a working group that this week proposed new guidelines for managing money market funds. Some of the guidelines, if regulators agree to them, include keeping more cash on hand and concentrating investments in safer, shorter-term debt.
So we are very much embracing the overall strengthening of an already strong industry.
But are money market funds really a good place to keep your rainy day dollars? It all depends on who you ask. Susan Moore is a financial planner from Watertown, Massachusetts. She's fielding a lot of questions from clients.
People are very concerned about safety, but they're also concerned about the fact that money market funds are paying such low rates of return at this point.
According to iMoneyNet, yields on money markets are averaging between a quarter and a third of a percent. So while Moore says she trusts money markets, right now she doesn't think they trump savings accounts.
I would say go to the online savings account first. You'll get a higher rate of return and you can still get the FDIC insurance.
Financial planner Andrew Tignanelli heads the financial consulate. He has a lot of concerns about the security of money markets. Still, he says the risks are relative.
I don't think you're going to wake up one day and lose 50% of your money in a money market fund. I think your biggest risk is you might lose 5.
He says some money market funds may be invested in shaky corporate or municipal debt. And given the currently tiny yields, the risks may not be worth the rewards. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
So last weekend in the New York Times, personal finance columnist Ron Lieber wrote that for some people, walking away from a mortgage might actually be the most sensible option. Whoa. But, you know, on this very program, we've noted that some of the old rules just don't apply anymore. It is a new era. Ron Lieber is with us. And let me ask you, were you surprised at what you wrote?
The thing that sort of surprised me about what happened after I wrote the piece was there was all this hate mail coming in from people who were saying, you know, you're encouraging people to break contracts and walk away from their obligations. And in fact, what I said was that it's almost always a better option to try and renegotiate with your lender. Lenders are in a forgiving mood and they're getting more so as the government mandates come down. So, you know, try and cut a better deal for yourself first and then consider the sort of thermonuclear option.
And you talk about the fact that, yes, there are some hits that you're going to take if you decide to do this. But the fact is, ultimately, for example, your credit score is going to come back.
Well, you know, make no mistake here. I mean, you will take a severe and lasting hit to your credit. There is just, you know, pretty much no way around it. You pretty much have to count on not being able to get a credit card for up to 7 years. You have to figure that if you can get a car loan at all, it'll cost you, you know, prevailing lowest rate is 5 or 6%. Now you might pay 10 or 12 or 14%. But again, you may be able to keep the credit cards that you currently have or simply use a debit card and you could pay cash for a used car or keep your car for 7 years. You know, if your credit score is 550 or 600, that's not going to, you know, keep you from living your life.
Here on this show, we've even mentioned that for some people, there may be good reason to, for example, tap their 401k for cash, not something we generally advise. I saw a recent column in one of your competitor publications that actually reviewed the pros and cons of borrowing from credit cards to create an emergency fund of cash. Is our current situation so unique that we can just kind of chuck some of the traditional advice?
Well, I think the thing you have to remember about retirement accounts, I mean, you mentioned those, is that, you know, those are protected in the event of a bankruptcy in general. I mean, the creditors are not going to be able to get their hands on those. You know, robbing a retirement account that could potentially, you know, help you through your golden years is a, you know, I mean, that's a pretty tough choice to have to make. And then, you know, putting yourself kind of further in debt to create an emergency fund. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if you lose your job, you can certainly, you know, take those cash advances against your credit card once that happens. I mean, you know, borrowing money at, you know, 15 or 20% just to create an emergency fund, that seems awfully extreme. These bad things that have happened, this unemployment, this underemployment, it's not going to happen to the majority, maybe even the vast majority of people.
You know, I wonder if there's also the risk that you're then encouraging the formation of bad habits that could hurt pretty seriously down the road.
Sure. Well, one way to look at this is the way that, you know, a lot of landlords are starting to look at it already, and even some credit unions, you know, they're looking at the credit reports of people who have already been through foreclosure, and they're saying, you know what, we are in unusual circumstances here, and if this person has a fairly clean record, aside from this, you know, kind of terrible foreclosure calamity or short sale, you know, that they've been through, we're going to give them a shot here. And in some ways, in fact, you know, going through this may kind of set you straight and cause you to have kind of such good habits and perhaps such conservative habits when things get better, that you won't ever be in a situation where something like this could happen to you again. I mean, that's what happens to some people who go through bankruptcy, right? So, you know, I don't necessarily believe that, you know, whatever rules we're suspending right now will cause people, you know, to want to suspend them forever. I think, you know, we're probably learning some valuable lessons right now.
Ron Lieber writes for the Your Money section of the New York Times. He's a columnist there. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
You know, we haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about Bernie Madoff, but about a week ago, he pleaded guilty to this massive Ponzi scheme that we've all been hearing about.
Yep.
$50 billion or so.
Maybe even more than that.
Maybe even more than that, yeah. Well, I wanted to get your take on an announcement this week from the IRS that it is going to allow Madoff's victims to claim up to 95% of their losses on their taxes. Now, Chris, we may be stepping into a bit of a hornet's nest here, but my first question was, if we do this for victims of Bernie Madoff and other recent Ponzi schemes, why shouldn't we do that for every victim of financial fraud?
I was equally troubled, and I'm not beating up on anybody that invested with Madoff. I mean, they've suffered a lot as it is. And my heart just goes out to like Elie Wiesel, a great man that Bernie Madoff took full advantage of, and all the charities that have lost money and the charities that have shut down. But the charities can't take advantage of the tax write-off. But I am very troubled. These are very wealthy people, by and large. These are people who had top-notch financial advisors, supposedly. And I just don't think that this tax law should be changed for this circumstance, because it raises, just as you said, Tess, when I heard about this, I go, well, what about all the homeowners that have had to sell their homes at a loss?
Right.
They can't take a tax loss on their taxes. They've suffered. And so I think it's a bad precedent to be setting. There's just going to be so many people that, you know, make mistakes and they're investing, and they're going to say, well, we need a break too. You know, we need the laws to be changed. Well, you did it for them. Why not for us? And all of a sudden, you sort of just opened up a tax code can of worms. And in the end, I don't think it's right.
So why do you think the IRS is doing this?
I think there are two reasons. They feel a lot of pressure, a lot of heat, that all this money is going toward institutions. It's going toward AIG. And all the money that's going into the banks. And
So we're helping corporate America and not individual victims.
Right. So now we've got to help out these victims. And, you know, I think this is the slippery slope.
I also wonder if there's anything to the fact that the IRS certainly got its share of all those phantom gains from Madoff victims. I mean, you know, as they cashed in their money, the IRS certainly took its portion of that. I don't suppose that you can do a clawback from the IRS.
Probably not. And you're absolutely right. But again, I think this is one of those changes that 5 years from now, there's going to be another victim. There's going to be another Ponzi scheme. There's going to be something else. You and I probably can't even imagine what it is, Tess,
yep.
Right? And then people are going to say, well, you did it for them. Why not for us?
Our own Chris Farrell with The Straight Story. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
If you're facing foreclosure, you have enough to worry about without con artists calling to sell you a refi.
I don't think most homeowners realize that once they go into default, that becomes a matter of public record.
That plus a look at other financial scams coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. This week, the Federal Reserve announced it would pump more than $1 trillion into the economy in an effort to loosen up credit markets. The immediate effect was a drop in mortgage interest rates. The national average for a 30-year fixed is now below 5%. Unfortunately, that is not going to help homeowners who are already facing foreclosure. And those folks are now in the crosshairs of another problem. Scammers promising they can help modify loans. Rachel Dornhelm has the story from Oakland.
By July of last year, Izet Tijinovic was frustrated. His work as a construction project manager was drying up. His home value had plummeted, and his lender wouldn't renegotiate the mortgage. And that's when his phone rang.
I don't know how it finds me and my number, but told me, you're looking for refinancing of the house. I tell yes.
After they talked for a few minutes, the woman on the phone told him he was perfect for their loan modification services. The father of two said hiring a professional to negotiate with his lender seemed like a good idea.
I think this, when somebody working every day with that, this is going to be more better. I know construction, not real estate.
She sent him an official-looking letter with a full money-back guarantee. He shipped off his documents and $3,000. He also followed the woman's instructions to stop making mortgage payments until her firm renegotiated his terms.
She said, don't call lender, don't talk with him when he call you. We're going to be care about everything.
After 3 months, the loan modification company said it had gotten his payments reduced and was sending the paperwork. It never arrived. He called repeatedly asking for his money back. He received a fraction of it. And the next thing he knew, his lender was foreclosing on his house because he had stopped making payments.
A lot of these companies are really preying on our borrowers who may have limited English skills or are not super financially sophisticated.
Sean Coffey is the director of a nonprofit housing counseling service. He's helping Tijinovic free of charge to file a real modification request. The two of them check in on its status every week.
He said it is still under review, but he did say it was a good sign that it was still under review. That if
Coffey also tried to help Tijinovic get his money back from the shady company.
We called them together from my office, and they would not speak to me, and they ended up hanging up on me. So
they filed a complaint with the county district attorney. Coffey says in the last month or two, more of his clients are coming in with stories like this. Same with nonprofit housing lawyer Mava Elise Brown. Brown says part of the issue is it's so easy to track people facing foreclosure.
The scam operations are going after victims by searching the public databases, for one. I don't think most homeowners realize that once they go into default, that that becomes a matter of public record and that anybody can find that information.
And it's not just names and addresses, but loan amounts and even the banks involved. That means any word processing whiz can come up with some pretty official-looking letters of help. Jeff Davy, the commissioner of California's Department of Real Estate, says last August he had no cases of loan modification scams.
As of now, we have around 300 cases in our department. Most of the people that we've seen so far are not licensed at all doing loan modification services, so they're doing it illegally to begin with.
Attorneys general from several states are taking on some of the biggest scammers. Meanwhile, the Federal Trade Commission has set up a special investigation unit. Brad Elbein is the head. He says his team has received thousands of complaints. They've filed 6 cases with many more on the way.
What we do is we try to collect the money, send it back to the people who have been victimized. Unfortunately, we can't undo the foreclosure if the victims have ended up in foreclosure.
Or, like Izet Tijinovic, are headed towards foreclosure. He says now he tells everyone to deal with only HUD-approved counselors in person, not over the phone and not over the internet. In Oakland, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace Money.
Sadly, foreclosure scammers aren't the only ones prowling around this defective economy. Raise your hand if you've gotten an email warning about back taxes you owe. Or maybe somebody mailed you a job listing that sounds perfect. You can see the details for a fee. Scam artists love a good recession, when we're all a little more vulnerable. For some help, we turn to Jürgen Wouters of Consumer Reports. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
I want to start, actually, with something I received in the mail recently. This is something called a property tax reassessment. And I'll tell you, it looks absolutely real. Looks like it came from the county assessor's office. They have my assessor's ID number. They have my address, and it's telling me they can help reduce my property tax. Now, there is a phone number on it, so I thought perhaps we would give them a call.
Thank you for calling Property Tax Adjustment Services. At this time, all agents are busy. If you would like further assistance, please leave a message with your name and number, and someone will get back to you within 24 hours.
Very interesting. What do you think of this?
Well, that sounds like a classic case of spear phishing.
Spear phishing. Okay, now I've heard of phishing. I think most people have. What is spear phishing?
regular fishing is kind of just, you know, like throwing a bunch of bait in the water or chumming for shark or something like that.
Right.
Spearfishing is a much more targeted type of fishing, you know, where the fishers actually get a hold of some of your personal information and design the email or sometimes, a mailing notice to make it look that much more legitimate, whether it's fake emails from the IRS. You know, we've seen some from Western Union, purporting to be from Western Union, rather. And unfortunately, due to the prevalence of social networking sites like Facebook and others, identity thieves are finding it very easy to find all sorts of personal information that makes spear phishing that much easier.
You mentioned the IRS, and we have seen the examples of the note that supposedly comes from the tax man talking about your economic stimulus refund. You know, if you don't contact us now, then your refund is going to be delayed because of the volume of requests that we get for this refund. What does the IRS say about this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you see these every year around tax time. And last year we saw even some more than usual because of the stimulus checks. And the IRS is quite clear about this. The IRS never initiates any kind of communication via email. It never requests detailed personal information such as PIN numbers, passwords, or the other types of things these emails ask for. You know, so the bottom line is if you get an email from the IRS and you haven't been in communication with them, it's a phishing attempt. Don't even think twice about it.
Well, you know, one of my colleagues here at Marketplace received what I think is another phishing or maybe spear phishing notice. It looks like a bill of some sort, although it does say it's not a bill. But at the top, it reads extremely urgent, time sensitive, and it's something about extending an auto warranty. Is this another example?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen these as well. We've heard about them from readers, and people here who work at Consumer Reports have also brought them to our attention. You know, and we've seen mailings like this that say, please have your, you know, VIN number ready when you
right.
call. And that's an obvious attempt to get personal information, and they're, Lord knows what they'll use it for.
What can you tell us about how to detect whether these are real or not? Because as I said, you know, this property tax one that I received, it looks like it came from the assessor's office.
What we recommend always is the first place, once you get one of these, if there's a phone number like the one that you received on yours, give it a call. Often you'll just get a machine or perhaps nothing at all. You know, any company you're doing business with, you know, whether it's a bank or whether it's Amazon or an ISP or what have you, whenever you do business with them, you should never conduct any business via email. Always do it over a secure website. Beyond that, use good antivirus software, use good anti-spyware software, and, you know, be very cautious about opening any attachment or downloading any files, even if it's from someone you know.
Jürgen Wouters is a reporter and senior producer for Consumer Reports Web Watch, the Internet Integrity Division of Consumers Union. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where your issues become our issues. And I'm here once again with Marketplace Economics editor Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So let's start with a tax question. And this email came in from Mary in Farmington Hills, Michigan. She writes, if the government nationalizes Citibank, she understands that the common stock she holds is worthless. But her question is she treated any differently on her income taxes because this will be due to a government action rather than to a sale by the shareholders?
No, she'll be able to take it off on her taxes.
Okay.
And that's going to be the real value of the stock at this point for her.
So it doesn't matter how or why this happened. If you're selling or if you're losing all this stock, you can still take it on your taxes.
Right, to offset capital gains. I hope she has some capital gains or ordinary income.
And next, we'll go to the phone and take a call from Michael in Boston. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. What's your question today?
In July, my wife and I are going to be moving across country to Los Angeles. My wife is going to be starting a medical residency. and I'm going to be starting a medical fellowship, and both these programs are going to last about 3 to 4 years. And we were wondering whether it would make sense for us to look into buying a condo when we move to Los Angeles. So there's a good chance that we would consider moving at the end of our 3 to 4 year residency or fellowship, that we would want to move. And so we don't know whether it would make sense, given that we may not want to stay there permanently.
I have a prediction that after you've lived here in sunny, beautiful Los Angeles for 3 to 4 years, you might actually not want to move. But setting that aside,
definitely possible.
You won't be doing any snow shoveling here, my friend. Chris, what do you think? I mean, if you're not planning to stay in the home for longer than these 3 or 4 years, is it worth buying right now?
It's too risky. The sort of standard rule of thumb in the industry is you shouldn't buy a home unless you're going to own it for more than 3 years. I'd actually lengthen that, and I feel you shouldn't buy a home unless you're going to be there for at least 5 years. If you go buy and then you're under that time frame, it's a speculation, not an investment.
Have you already made any sort of plans for buying? I mean, do you have things like a down payment and that sort of thing?
Well, we're very lucky that a family member gave us a gift, so we have about $100,000 for a down payment.
Which would buy you a closet in Los Angeles.
Right.
Well, the other thing, though, is that in 2-3 years, as the fellowship's kind of winding down, as the residency is winding down, and you do decide that Tess is right and you're going to be in L.A., I'm going to go out on a limb and say the prices probably won't have moved a whole lot. And you'll still have your down payment, this principal value. So I don't think you're really even taking much of a risk by just keeping that $100,000 in a safe parking place for cash. And then, of course, if you do move, if after the 3 or 4 years you do decide to move, then you can always use that for a down payment in your new place.
So you don't think we would be missing out on a buying opportunity while the market's low now?
You know, it's probably a safe forecast to say you will probably miss bottom. But what does that really mean? Let's say that the Los Angeles real estate market bottoms out sometime in 2009, picks up a little bit in 2010. But do you imagine runaway prices really skyrocketing? I can't come up with an economic scenario. I can come up with a scenario that says, okay, improves a little bit in 2010, improves a little bit in 2011. Sure, you miss bottom, but it's not as if you're just going to be behind and you'll never catch up.
Right. That's very helpful because, you know, our concern isn't that we would miss out on this opportunity. And I guess no one really knows, but it's helpful to know that we probably aren't going to do terrible if we wait a few years.
You know, all these questions are really risk-reward questions. Yes, there is a risk that the market does really pick up and takes off, but it seems like a pretty small risk compared to the risk that you might decide to pick up and move in 4 years and you become a landlord. I'd worry more about becoming a landlord than that prices are going to skyrocket.
Great. Well, that's very helpful.
Well, good luck with the move, and thanks for the call.
Great. Thanks again.
And Chris, before we go, we wanted to clear something up that a few people have been asking, including Marsha in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. She wrote in wondering, when we talk about income, you know, what percent of our income to allocate for housing, doing a debt-to-income ratio, that kind of thing, are we talking about before taxes or after taxes? Gross income or net?
It's a pre-tax. It's a gross income figure. You start looking at what you're making, because remember, you're going to get various deductions, and that starts playing a role. But this is sort of looking at gross income. And by the way, what I really want to emphasize, and I think I did during that discussion, I go more conservative.
All right. Well, thanks for writing in, Marsha, and hope that clears things up. If you've got a question, you can give us a call. The number is 877-ASK-MONEY. That's 877-275-6669. Or write us via email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The economy's been hitting a lot of sour notes this year, and the Newport Jazz Festival is now no exception. This week, organizers announced that due to the financial crisis, a major sponsor was forced to back out. Now the event that's seen performances by Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, well, it's going back to square one. But at least on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we can offer our own little jazz festival.
I usually take 10 minutes to warm up with scales. Then I'll warm up playing solos that I've transcribed, like Charlie Parker's Coco. I'll do it very slowly at first.
My name is Christopher Dawson, and I'm a jazz pianist. Basically, when I was a kid, my dad brought home a little toy organ, and I just started playing that. I think I would have found music even if my dad hadn't brought home that keyboard, because I remember being very, very young and hearing the Pink Panther theme that Henry Mancini wrote, and I just remember being blown away by it. I learned ragtime and Tin Pan Alley songs. I learned those things pretty quickly as a kid, and there weren't many other 10-year-olds playing Sweet Georgia Brown. So there was kind of a little market for a little 10-year-old wearing a straw hat to play this kind of music. Fortunately, I haven't had to make many compromises musically. One reason is that's all I really see for myself, because I can't play pop music. I'm not good at it. I do play a variety of forms of jazz, so I can cover a lot of bases in the jazz world. So as far as getting jobs and gigs, there's a lot of different places that I can fit in. One of the jobs that I've done was play with a big band, and every year we played for a very, very high-profile Hollywood Award ceremony. And the burden fell on me as the pianist when major, major celebrities were talking too long to give them a hint to encourage them to leave the stage. I would say that was really one of the most uncomfortable musical situations I've ever been in. The next year I got a call to do that, I turned it down. Annually, I figure I average between $37,000 and $40,000 a year. And fortunately, I've never been out of work to the point where I've had to take a day job. Balancing work and family, it's tough because I get paid to do a job, but I don't really get paid to practice. So I need to find time during the day to spend hours practicing, and then I've got to go to a job or teach a student before a job. And then as a musician, your hours typically are evening or holidays, which creates definitely some tension within the family. There are jokes that people have about musicians. A father and son are playing, and the father says to the son, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And the son says, "I want to be a musician." And the father says, "Well, son, you can't do both." I've never been a fan of these musical put-down jokes, because in my experience, I feel that I have been able to grow up and be a musician. So to me, those jokes just don't make sense.
That was jazz pianist Christopher Dawson. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Karen Ness. Shopping wisdom used to be, if you have to look at the tag, you can't afford it. Now, march to the counter and name your price.
The reality is today, shoppers should ask everywhere they go, whether it is Neiman Marcus or it's Walmart.
Retail bargaining is back in style, and it's up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and have I got a bargain for you? Personal finance advice on sale. No? Not a deep enough discount for you? Well, maybe I could talk with my manager and get an even better price. Still not enough? You want a free tote bag, too? Let me guess, you learned those bargaining skills at the mall. These days, it's definitely possible. Ashley Milne-Tite has her story.
Eulalia Brooks is a careful shopper. She always checks prices online before heading to a store. These days, she has good reason to be frugal. Her employer, a New York nonprofit, has made her job part-time. Until recently, she'd never tried haggling with a retailer and wasn't entirely sure how to do it.
Method number one was very much similar to the girl method of getting free drinks, of just saying please and smiling a lot.
It turned out retailers weren't as open to all that smiling as the guys in college, but she soon embarked on a more ambitious strategy. In January, Brooks had her heart set on a hard drive for her computer. She headed to an electronics store, part of a New York area chain. They didn't have her item on sale. Still, she was determined to get 20% off. She approached a friendly-looking sales guy and began her offensive. Did he know if her hard drive would be discounted anytime soon? Could he possibly use his employee discount to sell it to her?
The thing that was really telling for me was, even though he didn't have all the answers, he was willing to stay with me because he wanted to make the sales, which I was like, oh, he probably works on commission. So he wants this sale really badly.
She asked if she could talk to a manager, then told the woman the item was cheaper online, whipping out her iPhone to prove it. After several minutes of back and forth, the manager offered her a 10% discount. Then the original sales assistant rang up the purchase.
He gave me an additional 10% on top of that, which was his employee's discount. So I got the 20% off overall, and so I got it at the sale price that I wanted.
Triumph. But Dan Butler of the National Retail Federation says shoppers shouldn't expect to get that lucky too often.
At most retailers, it is illegal for you as an employee to give your friends your discount. And in most retail companies, it's grounds for termination.
He says stores have markdown budgets and they can't go beyond them. Also, many states and counties have laws about price integrity. But retail consultant Wendy Liebman says in this economic environment, stores are often more flexible than they care to admit.
The reality is today, shoppers should ask everywhere they go, whether it is Neiman Marcus or it's Walmart.
And she says they are, and they're not ashamed of it. Her company surveys shoppers all over the US.
We are seeing that anywhere from 6 out of 10 people and higher in some cases are saying, I am proud of all the little ways I've learned to save, whether they're high income or low income.
Bargainers have traditionally had more luck in smaller neighborhood stores where the owner runs the place and is willing to bend on price. Allison Hoot owns vintage clothing store Hootie Couture in Brooklyn.
Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Allison.
Since she buys used merchandise, Hoot has more leeway than other retailers to bargain with customers and still make a profit. And she doesn't object to shoppers angling for a better price. But she says etiquette applies no matter where the haggling takes place. I ask her what works.
So Sarah was a customer and I came in here today.
Yes.
And I looked at this coat and I said, you know, I like that coat, but it's too expensive. What would your reaction be?
Well, if you said that straight to my face, like, oh, it's too expensive. You, as the customer, don't want to insult me. Because once you insult, you get yourself in trouble because you've closed the door on the relationship.
Hoot says instead,
your approach needs to be gentle, warm, and realistic.
She says start by asking if there's any flexibility on the price. And don't forget to smile and maintain eye contact as you wheel and deal. But can you grin and bargain as stores everywhere shut down and lay off workers? Shouldn't we all be paying full price to keep retailers in business? Eulalia Brooks doesn't think so.
If you're respectful and they don't mind, they rather me actually shop, buy something smaller, buy something a little less over the duration of the time is versus not seeing me for months on end.
In a way, she says she sees bargaining as doing her small part to keep the economy afloat. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
We are back with more Getting Personal, and I'm here again with economics editor Chris Farrell. And Chris, we have a question from Glenn in Anita, Iowa. He wants to know if it's possible to have more than one IRA account. The one he is in is losing money. Can he open another one that is perhaps safer, more conservative?
Absolutely. You can have one, two, three, four,
Chris can count.
Five. You know, I've been learning things. You know, it takes me a little while to pick these things up. No, you can have more than one IRA account. You can usually just use your IRA and put it in a different investment. For example, maybe you have it in, well, shall we say, an equity mutual fund. You can probably just put it into some government treasuries or into a CD. Within that account, but if you can't, you want to open up a separate one, yes, you can.
But of course, the limits on how much you can put in there per year are the same, so you'd want to make sure that you don't exceed that no matter how many IRAs you have, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, next we have an email from Paul in LaGrange, Illinois, and he's wondering how 529 college savings plans affect financial aid. He has heard that students who have 529 plans are not eligible. Any truth to this?
No. Now, 529 money is treated as a parental asset, and therefore it doesn't count that much in the financial aid formula. However, private colleges, private universities, they can kind of do whatever they want. They tend to treat it that way, but if they want to treat it differently, private colleges and universities can treat home ownership differently, retirement plans differently if they want. But typically, it's counted as a parental asset, and therefore it's treated well in the financial aid formula.
Okay, so it is in that formula, but there is no truth to this notion that if you have a 529, you are not eligible at all for financial aid.
No, absolutely not.
Next up, we have a call from Pat in Indianapolis. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Tess, Chris.
So we've just been talking about 529 plans and other college savings. I understand that you're about to send a son off to college.
I am. I have an 18-year-old who's going to be starting in the fall.
Well, good for him. So is the question about college savings?
Yeah, I got a suggestion from a friend a few days ago, and it almost makes sense to me, but I'm not quite sure if it entirely does. So
okay.
It was actually my son who said, well, let's ask Chris Farrell.
All right.
All right.
We've already got an early listener. Well done.
See, I'm raising him right. Here was the suggestion. Stocks are on sale right now, in a sense, and I don't have cash to invest right now because I've been preserving some in order to start paying for the college expenses. My friend said, why not take out student loans, pay the first couple of years with that, invest your cash, and see if the market recovers by the time you're paying the loans back. So I wanted to know if that made sense to Chris.
I'm going to give you the same answer, Pat, that I've given over the years. I used to get a variation on this question with home equity loans. And at that time, home equity loans, I can't remember the exact figure, but say you could take out a home equity loan at 5%, market's going to return somewhere between 7 and 8%. It seemed like a good deal. The problem is we don't know when the market's going to recover. I actually kind of agree with you about the sale, but that doesn't mean they won't be for sale for the next 10 years. Those payments start once your son graduates from college, and then those debt payments have to be made, and the stock market may still be in the doldrums. It's not crazy. It's not insane, but I don't like the idea of using borrowed money in the stock market because it's too risky.
And I sure have heard you say that, which I've appreciated knowing all these years, and I guess the thing that made it seem different right now was the potential for above-average gains seems higher now than it normally does.
It absolutely does. But what we don't really know, and I mean, I agree with you. I think right now what's happening is you have Warren Buffett and a lot of the value investors, they seem to be putting money in the market. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't have another, you know, decade like the 70s where you get these little brief rallies. But really, the market goes nowhere for a long period of time. And essentially, the market went nowhere. And it wasn't until August 1982 that it bottomed out. And we didn't really realize that it hit bottom until, what, about 85? We kind of figured out, ooh, yeah, it really is. This is for real. So you could be setting yourself up for a pretty nerve-wracking time.
Well, you've convinced me.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Pat.
My pleasure.
And after Pat's son is out of college, there will hopefully be a great job waiting with health insurance. But if not, well, last week, Chris, we said that recent college grads could stay on the family health plan through COBRA coverage. And that is true.
Yes.
But we do want to clarify that they do not qualify for the 65% reimbursement from the government. You can find the details of who does get that benefit at the Department of Labor website. That's www.dol.gov. If you type COBRA into the search area, a frequently asked question file comes up and it will explain who gets help with coverage under the stimulus package. And unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for Getting Personal this week. Give us a call. Leave a message with your question anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. Or write to us. You can find the link to send an email at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks, as always, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Fallout from the economic crisis is forcing many, if not most of us, to rethink our financial futures. We're saving more, we're spending less, reviewing everything from how often we go out to dinner to which college we can afford to send the kids to and what our retirement is going to look like. But all of that assumes that we have time to make those changes, time to reevaluate our priorities. But if you're nearing or in retirement, the calculations become much more stark. Stuart Ritter is a financial planner with T. Rowe Price, and he's been doing a lot of those calculations for clients recently. He graciously entered our studios last week as I was still recovering from a bout with laryngitis.
Thank you for having me.
The advice that we've been giving over these last several months is to not panic, keep with your buy and hold strategy that the markets will rebound. But so often when we say that, we get listeners who write in and say, excuse me, I don't have a long time to rebound. And we're talking, of course, here about people who are in their probably 50s or 60s and beyond, who look at what's happened in the markets and say, oh my goodness, what do I do? What's your first piece of advice for them?
What we try to do is help people shift their perspective a little bit. In reality, they do have a long time. For someone who's age 65, they can think about a 30-year retirement. Hmm. So one of the things that helps is to say you've got two 15-year periods in that 30-year retirement, the first 15 years and the second 15 years, which means conceptually you're not using half your money until 15 years from today. So you actually do have a long time period for part of what you've saved for retirement.
It's interesting to hear you say that because I think there is this notion among so many of us that, you know, you hit 65, that's the end of your investing cycle, you know, that
exactly.
You have to have all of the money for your retirement by the time you hit 65 or whatever your retirement age is.
And a lot of people think, well, that's when everything ends. Retirement is
hopefully
simply,
not.
Hopefully not. Yes, exactly. Retirement is just the beginning of the next phase of your life. So you need to think about making sure you have a plan in place that's going to work the first year, but also going to work in the 10th year and the 20th year and the 30th year.
You know, one other piece of wisdom that we have even put forth on this show is that, you know what, if you are approaching your retirement age, you shouldn't have been really in a good percentage of stocks in the first place. And again, people write in and say, yeah, that's all well and good. And yeah, I should have known that. But the fact is I was. And I had, you know, I was counting on big returns to get me to where I needed to be to retire. And now I'm not there. So what can they do right now to try to make up for some of these significant hits to their portfolios?
Here's something that's counterintuitive for people. People are suffering because of what's happened to their investments. So their instinct is to look to do something with their investments to fix it. The counterintuitive part is you need to look in other places to do that. The way you can get yourself back on track are things like working a little bit longer, saving a little bit more, delaying Social Security for a couple of years before you start taking those checks. So it may not be as radical as people are fearing that it is. Getting a plan in place, understanding where you are, and knowing what steps you might need to take to get back to the point you want to be at.
You know, we have people writing in who say, I'm done. I am done with the stock market. Can't tolerate this. I am so over risking all my money in something that could just crash any day. What happens to them?
If you decide to move out of the stock market, that's certainly a choice, but you can't just do that. If you're not going to have the chance for growth that equities provide, you need to decrease the amount you're spending. Or if you're still saving, you need to increase the amount you're saving. So it's certainly a choice for people to get out of the stock market, but they can't stop there.
What about the double whammy of someone who is nearing retirement who has also lost a job?
That is very difficult for people. One of the things folks can think about is continuing to work, but maybe not in the place they were before. Even a part-time job can be helpful. If you get a job, say, for $20,000 a year, for the time you have that job, that's the functional equivalent of having an extra $500,000 saved for retirement, because the $500,000 would generate $20,000 a year of income. So if you can generate that on your own, that helps make up for the money you may not have anymore. So it doesn't have to be an all or nothing approach. I have to keep my full-time job or nothing's going to work. part-time jobs can help, saving a little bit more can help, doing a lot of these incremental kinds of things will help get you back where you need to be.
So you're a certified financial planner, one of the folks who we all come to for advice. How have you personally weathered this economic crisis?
I feel the same thing everybody else has been feeling. I've lost money. You've probably lost money. Nobody's happy about what's going on. I think it's a very humbling time for people. At the same time, it's not all about 2008. The world didn't start with the 2008 bear market. It's entirely likely it's not going to end with the 2008 bear market. And it's important to keep that future perspective and make sure the steps you're taking today are going to prepare you for that future, not just the next year or two.
But what about all the folks who are saying that this market is going to take a really long time to recover?
People have said that in the past. No one can predict the future. Every time we've said that things are different this time, whether it's been the death of equities or it's the new economy, so internet stocks will always go up.
Right.
We have always been wrong. The American economy continues to evolve. What you can do is put a portfolio together that gives you the best chance of success no matter what future comes out, and then focus on the things you can control.
Stuart Ritter is a certified financial planner with T. Rowe Price. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how is a car like an apartment? You can get great discounts on both right now, but getting a deal on a cute coupe is slightly different than asking for lower rent.
Unlike the car dealer, you're going to have a lot to do with this landlord in the future.
Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troe. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.